you can't just do the one thing forever. I can't think of anybody who's done just the one thing forever and been able to make a lifelong career out of it. Not saying it's not possible, I just don't know any examples of it.
Welcome to the Idea Generation Podcast, a show about creative entrepreneurship. My name is Noah Callahan Bever, and each week I get to talk to some of the most innovative ideators in culture and try to figure out how they make their creative decision. The best way to support us is to leave a rating or a review on your favorite podcast platform. It only takes a second, but it can make a world of difference in helping others discover the show. And of course, don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. This week, I have the extreme privilege of hosting a true legend, a man responsible for some of the greatest rap music ever created, Justin Just Blaze Smith. One of the most accomplished music producers of a generation, an architect of Rockefeller's signature sound, and now an entrepreneur in many spaces, including a disruptive play to bring diversity to the video game industry, Just Blaze is a true Renaissance man. But before all of that, he was just a young beatmaker with a couple placements whose name I vaguely knew from the liner note. But then I had a pretty extraordinary interaction that would completely sell me on his genius. In September of 2000, I was writing a show called Direct Effect on MTV. It was their live daily hip-hop answer to TRL. So one afternoon, MTV's head of talent relations, Fred Jordan, RIP, pops into my office on 25 and asks if I want to hear the new Jay-Z album. Which, duh, of course I want to hear the new Jay-Z album. So anyway, I follow him up to his office on 27, and who is sitting there all by themselves? Yep, Jay-Z. Unfortunately, Jay only has the album on a DAT, and Fred does not have a DAT player in his office. So he has to go run around the building to try to find one, which leaves my extremely awkward 20-year-old self extremely alone with the biggest rapper in the world. So naturally, Jay breaks the ice with, "So Fred says you're the hip-hop guy." And then he does that Hove laugh, where you don't really know if he's making fun of you. Anyhow, he then proceeds to grill me on my top Big Daddy Kane and top Rakim verses of all time. We agree on Raw, but we agree to disagree on Rakim. I was Team Juice, but he was adamant about my melody. In fact, he even rapped the 7MC line to me just to prove his point. Anyhow, finally, Fred returns and I am totally relieved. Jay pops in the tape and he plays us the Dynasty intro. And what? Jay just chuckles and says something to the effect of, "What's the point of an intro if it doesn't prove that you're the best rapper alive?" Then he does that weird Hove laugh again. Of course, we made him play it like three more times in a row, and I got to inquire who produced it, because as godly as those verses are, the beat was also unlike anything I had ever heard. So he says Just Blaze. The dude that did the Siegel Bleak song? Isn't he more of like a keyboard guy? I asked, knowing nothing of Just's pedigree outside of Who Want What. Jay just smiled and said, "Oh nah, you gotta hear what he gave me for this album." And then he pressed play. What followed was a rough draft of Rockefeller's signature sound, and Just's contribution, the most aggressive, noisy, and belligerent of the bunch, were the ones that spoke to my soul. He took everything that I loved about sample-based hip-hop production from the 90s, and he combined it with the bass-heavy, ear-splitting percussion of the Triton era, and he made something that was both completely modern and completely classic. Over the next 20-plus years, he would refine and redefine his sound over and over, and amass a catalog that is uniquely evenly divided between quintessential B-sides like Exhibit C, PSA, and Kingback, and ubiquitous pop hits like Throwback, Rock the Mic, and Live Your Life. Needless to say, I felt insanely fortunate to sit with him for this week's episode of the Idea Generation Podcast to discuss his path, his passions, and his next chapter as a creative leader of the Brassline Entertainment video game studio. Anyhow, enough NCB story time. Let's hear how he did it in his words. The Idea Generation Podcast is brought to you by Tres Generaciones Tequila.
How did your parents' professional lives inform your career ambitions?
My mom was an educator. She was an English teacher. Then she went on to become, I think, the assistant to the superintendent of schools for the city, Patterson, where I grew up. And then she spent some time as the vice principal of Eastside, the school from Lean On Me. And then finished her run as the principal of Rosa Parks Fine Arts High School. So if I had to say how her profession informed me, discipline. She instilled code switching very early. She's like, listen, when you're out with your friends and you want to say word, man, word, you can do that. But there are certain situations where you're going to have to get a refit. And that was, she was really just giving me life lessons in terms of just how to move. Her take was very informed because she was around high school kids. So she really just taught me a lot about how to move through life and deal with people. And then my dad was a computer programmer for all intents and purposes, an IT guy. That was his profession, but his passion was music, playing keys. He played jazz organ and piano. So it was kind of like the reverse of my life. Growing up around computers and his programming and growing up around him playing keys literally informed what I do, like before I even knew it. Like, he'd have keyboards and like basic synthesizers around the house, and growing up, follow behind what your dad does. You always think you're gonna get in trouble for doing what the adults do, right? Like as a kid, just innately, like I'm probably not supposed to do this. But I would play his keys. And I remember one day, like I'm sitting there just essentially making a beat, not even knowing what making a beat was, right? Like I'm programming drums, I'm playing a bass line, I'm playing keys on it. And I'm thinking that nobody knows. And then I look up and my parents are both like looking through the door, like, and I'm like, oh my God, I'm gonna get in so much trouble. And they're like, no, keep going. So yeah, him unwittingly providing that creative technical environment. And my mom, who's also a singer as a hobby, but also providing that discipline, just created the environment that I ended up thriving. People always ask about like the secret to your success, and they always expect some big grand answer, and I'm just like, nah. It's the fact that my family was supportive once they realized this talent that I had. I feel like all of us get at least one shot at greatness in life. You might not even realize it when you get it, but if you don't have that support system, that chance can pass you by, you don't even realize. I was very, very fortunate to grow up in that environment. And even though they didn't understand the specifics, like my mother didn't know what DJing was. Like she was like, you want a mixer? What's a mixer? I had a show in the Radio Shack catalog. I must have been like in fourth or fifth grade. And I'm not even thinking I'm going to get the mixer because it's $60, right? So $60 when you're 8 years old just seems like, especially in that era, so seemed like so much money. She didn't understand it, but she bought it. Or when I wanted turntables, or Roland had a sampler called the JS-30. And it seemed like the answer to all my dreams, right? And it was like $1,200 at the time. And I must have been 12, I think.
Yeah, 11. That's a ton of money at 12.
Right, exactly. So, but come Christmas, there it was under the tree. And you get older, the adults in the family start to reveal certain things, right? So it was like, you come to find out that like, she paid that thing off over like 8 years. Or like my aunt, Jenny, who bought me my ASR 10, because at the time Wu-Tang, RZA was the biggest thing in the world, and that's what RZA used, so I needed that. That was like $3,000-$4,000, and come to find out that she spent X amount of years paying that off. Like even after I'd been successful, which I could have easily just paid it all for, but I didn't know that they were still paying for it. That was their way of doing their part and supporting me on my journey.
That's crazy. Your dad was a programmer. My dad programmed video games in the 80s.
Really?
Yeah. He worked for Sid Meier.
Wow.
I think about like just having that like Atari 800 in the crib in that moment, how consequential that was to framing how I looked at the world.
Right.
Understanding how programming languages work and
right.
whatnot. For the way the world would bend. I imagine that was probably very consequential for you.
1,000%. I started, I guess what we would now call coding, fourth grade. I actually used to like write very rudimentary basic, no pun intended. I used to program in basic.
Which is crazy to do before you've taken algebra to understand
right. Well, that,
the
that,
idea
so,
of a variable and.
Right, so like, it's funny, I've never actually thought about this or now that you mention it. But like, yeah, so I understood, to me it was all logic, right? It's if X plus Y is 5, then you, or whatever, X plus 2 is 5, then obviously X is 3,
yeah.
Right? So like, I understood that concept or idea at a very young age. So like, by the time, I remember being like in sixth grade and the math teacher was like, oh, one day you'll be studying algebra. And here's an example. And she just started asking questions to the class just to kind of gauge to see who might knew what. And I was knocking out the questions left and right. And everybody's looking at me like, oh my God, you're a genius. And I'm like, no, this is just, it's logic, right? And that's really what it was. I guess for better or worse, I tend to look at the world through a very logical lens. A lot of that comes from just understanding the idea of logic from a young age due to coding.
You also clearly were bit by the hip-hop bug and the music bug at an incredibly young age.
Right.
7, 8 years old, you're thinking about getting mixers and DJing and whatnot. Were you looking at it like this is a career path? Or
I knew that it's what I wanted to do with my life. I didn't think that it would actually be, possible. Because, especially at that age, right, it's like watching superheroes on TV. You know what I mean? Like, you're watching Friday Night Videos and Hot Tracks, Carlos, and you're listening to Magic and Molly and Red and Chuck. It's all delegated to like the same 2 to 3 hour slot on two nights, right? So it's like anything hip hop only happens on TV or on the radio on Friday and Saturday night from like 9 p.m. to midnight, right? So you watched or you listened to Friday night mix shows, Saturday night mix shows from 9 to 12, and then at 12, Hot Tracks and Friday Night Videos came on. And then you had to wait a week to get exposed to it again. You know, then you then enter Run DMC, and all of a sudden, rap starts to get played a little bit on the radio here and there. And obviously, things progressed from there. It was always, again, like reading a comic book. It's not something that you actually feel like is attainable. And as time went on, and our talent is developing, and my family is supporting it, and I'm getting local DJ jobs and making demos with the kids in the neighborhood. It always just seems like something, it's still just something fun to do.
This is like early high school?
Yeah, you know, throughout grammar school. I started DJing like actual parties by the time I was like 11.
Oh, wow. Okay.
By high school, I'm doing full-on like nightclubs, like wild underage, having to be snuck in and out of the DJ booth. Mom sitting outside with the car at 2 a.m. on a school night.
That is very supportive.
Yeah. But it wasn't until college, when I went to Rutgers, it wasn't until around then that it became humanized. I had a very good friend of mine to this day, Malik Griffin. His name is DJ Porto, right? And he was down with Boom Squad, which was Artifacts. There was a nightclub in Newark called The Pipeline. And they would have what they called a Fat Funkin' Wednesdays. And it was like a open mic slash DJ exhibition. They would have MC battles, they'd have DJ battles, and they were gracious enough to just let me DJ, you know? And what ended up happening was you would have Tame, L, Red, occasionally, Lords of the Underground, Outsiders, all these groups that I idolized at the time were all of a sudden like performing like live right in front of me. And Digga actually most F as well. It used to be an open mic thing. And I would just play whatever beats were popular at the time and MCs would run. So eventually I built up the courage to play my own beats kind of as interludes in between the artists that were performing. And I remember one night, Tame and L, along with the Outsiders, were there. And it wasn't like one of our big build, like open mic nights. They just happened to show up and wanted to rock. And Z comes up to me, Young Z from the Outsiders, and gives me a copy of his new 12-inch show with KRS. It was called The Milk. So I'm just tripping off the fact that Young Z gave me his record, right? So like, I play his record, and then right after that, I play one of my beats. So they go to get on stage, and I switch. I think I was going to play Z's instrumental for them to rhyme to. And they're like, nah, put the other beat on. So I'm thinking they want the last record I played. So I play that. They're like, nah, put the beat you were just playing. It was my beat. So artists that I look up to, who, like I said, at that point was superheroes, all of a sudden they're asking to rhyme to something that I made. So all of a sudden, it's like, oh, maybe this is something I can actually do. Because up until that point, the idea was always, I'm going to be a computer programmer like my dad. And whether it's writing video games or whether it's writing corporate infrastructure stuff or whatever, like, that was the idea. And I figured I would just be making music as a hobby. And it was right around that time is when it was like, oh, wait a minute, maybe I actually can do it.
It's crazy how such a small interaction can put a battery in your back that can change your life. Mm-hmm. I do have to ask, how did you graduate high school at 16?
I got skipped a couple times. Nowadays, it's more so like, you see your kid is advanced in certain areas. They just put them in certain classes to support their advancement or certain programs or whatever. Back in the 80s, it was just like, oh, he's a genius. Take him out of kindergarten, put him in third grade. And that's what they did. And I remember my mom came, because they had skipped me like two or three grades. And she came to a school for whatever reason, but it was around the time that I was at recess. And she saw me in the playground with these kids that were like 3 years older. And she was just like, nah, put him back. It's not about the academics. Socially, he's nowhere. He's at a different stage in his life. And he doesn't know how to interact with kids this age. So they ended up knocking me back like 2 years, but I'm still ahead a year.
When you think about the Rutgers experience, obviously you went in thinking that you were going to walk a sort of straight, narrow path to computer programming. What did you get out of that? And would you do it over knowing that you can land in this other creative field?
I honestly don't remember one thing that I technically learned at school. And I feel like a lot of us don't, right? What I really learned during my time at Rutgers, just how to deal with people, social skills, how to navigate through life in general. In terms of the actual academic side of it, I don't remember anything. I'm not anti-school, but in my particular experience, I remember at a certain point just being in my classes and being like, I'm wasting my mother's money. I'm wasting these grants or school loans, whatever it was I had. And right around that same time is when I got the opportunity to intern at the Cutting Room. But most of us, right, we go to school and the goal is to get out of school and get a job within a field that you love, right? Or what you majored in or whatever. And this internship lands in my lap. And it's like, well, I could go to school for 4 years and hope to land a job computer programming or doing something in music. But I have an internship right in front of me right now, right? So imagine having a mom who was an educator and a principal and having to go home and explain to her that you want to drop out of school because you have this opportunity to make to work in your field. And I had already talked to one of my cousins, who was an older cousin, but kind of like my mom's little brother. So I had already talked to him about it. I had talked to my aunt, who's my mom's little sister, about it. So I didn't know that they had already had a conversation with her, like, yo, this is what he wants to do, and he's going to ask you about this. So we're sitting at the dinner table one night, and I finally get the nerve to bring it up, like, hey, I want to do this during my winter break. And she did the thing, parents mess with you sometimes, and she ice-grilled me, like, hey, so you want to leave school, huh? And I pay how much for school every year, blah, blah, blah. She's putting me through the ringer. I don't know that she's just messing with me. Like, so eventually she said, all right, let me ask you a question. She said, what will make you happy? I said, yes. She said, as long as you in your health, maintain your happiness, respect others, and make sure that they respect you, do whatever you want to do, you can leave school. And I was like, wait, what? Because I was prepared for her to just be like, no. She said, yeah, go ahead. So yeah, I never went back to Rutgers. Literally just left, didn't like unofficially unenroll or didn't officially unenroll, whatever, just never went back. Which ended up biting me in the ass because I wasn't thinking about the fact that the loans or whatever had to be paid back. So years later, things hit your credit report. You're like, wait, what? They have me in their notable alumni section. Like, that's when you get like the honorary degree and whatnot. They've asked me to show up and speak at events and whatnot. But I'm going back there like, hey, so I had a $1,500 loan. I didn't know. Can I just pay it back and you guys take it off my credit report? They're like, no. And I'm like, but I can give you the money right now. They're like, you can give us the money. We're not taking it off the credit report.
When you're thinking about getting this internship to work in a studio, mm-hmm. in your mind, are you thinking, I'm going to be a record producer?
I am one step closer to being in around what I want to do.
Music paying the bills.
Yes, I'm in the environment. Whether I'm a studio manager, whether I'm a producer, whether I'm an audio engineer, whatever it is, I'm here. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, and that was really the goal. My title was general assistant, meaning I might be answering the phones one day. I might be engineering a session for Mobb Deep the next. I might be getting coffee for somebody after that. You know what I mean? It was just whatever I needed to do, I was there. I got to watch a lot of classic music be made. Like, my first night there was session with George Clinton, Q-Tip, and Old Dirty Bastard. Like, and I'm literally just walking in for the first time, like, hi, guys. You guys need any coffee, whatever? Oh, my God. Like, from that to, like, Hell on Earth be made. That whole Mobb Deep run from Hell on Earth, the next three albums. Okay. Literally watched all of them. Like, you name any classic Mobb record. Like, I watched Have make the White Lines beat. Or Quiet Storm, rather. Like, watched Godfather Part 3 again. Watched Bose record Black on Both Sides. Because Ruckus was right next door. So anything that Platinum Island Studios was also next door. It was downstairs from Ruckus. If Platinum Island didn't have studio time, then Cutting Room was right next door. Watched a ton of Ruckus stuff get made. Loud Records, Violator. Rest in peace, Chris Lighty. A lot of Violator, which is how I ended up initially meeting Rod Digger. Because before she was Flip Mode, Q-Tip had signed up. So, like, I want to say, like, my second session, I think, was actually working a Rod Digger session.
As an engineer?
As an intern. I think I ended up assistant engineering the session. But the wild thing was, I'm assisting this Rod Digger session. And then, like, a week later, I'm hanging out with Porn and Black 45 and all these dudes from Newark. It was an open mic thing. But Digger shows up and performs the song I had helped her record a week before. So again, this is now something that I've worked on, like, in a very medial capacity. Like, I didn't work on the song itself, but I was just assisting the session. But this is something that I'm a part of, and I'm watching it be performed on stage. Even if it's a small stage, I'm watching it be performed. So again, it's just one of those things where it's like, oh, you can do this.
I know your first actual credit is this very random Mr. C record.
Yes.
Where and all of that?
Mr. C thing happened years before.
Okay, so that's still
that's
like high school?
Literal, like, that's got to be high school, if not, like, right out of high school. But I'm pretty sure I'm still in high school. No, you know what? I think that was the summer that I graduated, now that I think about it. It came about while I was still in school. Okay. Like, in terms of the formation of it, but I think by the time it came out, I might have maybe just graduated high school.
So you're DJing, like, a skate rink? Uh-huh. And you get Mr. C to come headline yep. for the night. And then how does it go from there to you getting this credit on Shake That Ass?
Right. So I used to DJ at this rink called Skater's World. And it was me, my little brother, a bunch of the neighborhood kids. We kind of had our own crew called the FOB. FOB never stood for anything. We just...
that's amazing.
Yeah, rest in peace to Freddie Fox. One of our homies, his thing was when he would show up, they would be like the guys that carried the crates, right? So that's how they would get into the parties. So I remember one day a bouncer was like, who are you guys? And he's like, you don't know what's with an FOB. And the bouncer was like, okay, my bad, I didn't know. And let him in. So the name just stuck, but it never actually meant anything, never stood for anything. But so we developed a pretty decent following locally. And eventually the parties got so big that we were able to start booking people. So we booked Mr. C, the DJ, and Wendy Williams to host. C comes, and Wendy's doing her walkthrough and doing the host thing. C's watching me play my set, and he hears me go into my Jersey Club set. And at the time, Jersey Club is literally like outside of Jersey or Baltimore, you don't hear it. So he never heard any of this stuff. So, like, I'm playing all the early classics, Whores in His House, Stick Control, and Shake That Ass. So he hears the set. He comes over like, yo, what is this? And I'm like, yeah, I just start naming the records. He's like, no, what is this genre? What is this music? So we exchange information. I reach out to him. He's like, yo, call me. At the time, he's working at Cold Chillin' still. He's like, yo, come to the Cold Chillin' office. We should talk. And do me a favor, bring me these records. So my cousin, Carwin, drives me to meet C at the Cold Chillin' office. Now, again, imagine, I mean, you understand the rap nerdery, right? So imagine being 16, walking, or maybe barely 17, and you're being invited to Cold Chillin', and you're walking in, and, like, in the middle of that. Yeah. And so my mind is just blown. I end up giving C all the records and just talking to him about what parts to play, what parts to use. And I'm just giving him all the game, right? Like, this is where you start this record from. This is the break that you want to play on this one. Not expecting any kind of credit or anything, but I kind of gave him a whole walkthrough of Jersey Club and what was what. So when he flipped, shake that ass, and kind of did it the way I broke it down to him, he gave me a credit on the record.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
So it seems like there's a confluence of these moments that are, I would imagine, creating some confidence that this is a permeable industry for you. You're 17. You're doing parties with Z and Outs. And
right.
You're in the Cold Chillin' office. So now you're engineering at the Cutting Room. You have the night manager gig. You've fully dropped out of school.
Mm-hmm.
Are you strategizing on a path forward?
I'm just happy to be there, bro. The music getting made, soaking up game along the way. Engineers allowing me to sit in on sessions and learn from them. I don't have a plan.
Are you making music in your downtime?
The thing I always say, it's super cliche at this point, but I always say it, like, from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m., I was Justin Smith, assistant studio manager. From 7 p.m. to 9 a.m., I was just Blazing Training. And I might get an hour of sleep in between. And that's why I have permanent bags under my eyes, because I spent 3 years literally not sleeping. Really had no plan. Funny enough, at a certain point, I was thinking to myself, it might be time to go back to school, because I'm soaking up a lot of game. I'm learning so much, but, like, it's nothing's landing. At the same time, I wasn't really pushing for anything to land. It was kind of just one of those things where it was like, all right, I had fun. Let me go back to school. Because the idea was always, this is a temporary thing. If nothing big happens, then I will go back to Rutgers and finish off my last year and a half, whatever it was. And that same week is when I had a chance meeting with Mace, which led to me doing the Harlem World record. The way it all happened, like I said, I was just Blazing in training at night, right? So sometimes when you knew that certain artists were working in other rooms, you might leave the door cracked and work on music in the hopes that or just have your music playing in the hopes that somebody would walk past and say, hey, what's that? So one night, Mace's management, they were sequencing something. They weren't recording. They were sequencing a sampler tape or something in one room. So I left the door cracking. Sure enough, somebody eventually poked their head and like, yo, what's that? Started playing the music. And it was nothing like what I ended up doing for them. But Super Sam was the dude who came in. The homie Sam.
He was part of Kuda's.
Sam was right under Kuda. Like, okay. Sam was Kuda's right hander. So he brings Kuda in the room. And I'm just playing the music. So Sam was actually like, yo, so you think we can make a beat out of New Edition Popcorn Love? And I was like, sure. He's like, make that. Come to the Hit Factory Thursday. We'll call you on Wednesday to confirm. So they hit me on Wednesday, like, yo, the session's set up. Come to the Hit Factory tomorrow. Whatever time it was, I remember the time. I go to the Hit Factory that Thursday with the new edition. Sam hadn't even heard it. He just knew that I was going to be able to do what needed to be done. So I go in, I play him a bunch of other stuff, and Mace liked it all. Like, we ended up cutting, like, 6 or 7 records. A couple of them got leaked. I think maybe only 2 made the album. But a couple got pressed up on white labels and just leaked to mixtape DJs. But I play with a bunch of stuff. Mace is like, yeah, all this is dope. So then Sam's like, yo, play the new edition beat. So I play that. Mace immediately starts jumping up and down. Like, this is my single. And Sam just looked at me like, I told you. You know, so yeah, it definitely was not in the wheelhouse of what I would normally do, but it was what I had to do to get in the game, basically. 30 days later, I'm watching the video premiere on TV, like still sitting at my job at the cutting room on the couch. We're all sitting there watching it like, yo, Justin's song is about to come on TV. And the video premieres. That's when I was like, all right, thank God I didn't go back to school because I was literally about to quit and go back like the week before.
Just Blaze's decision not to go back to college would pay off handsomely, both for him and for the history of rap music. As we've seen time and time again on Idea Generation, dropping out of college is not always the worst move. If you're willing and able to use the time you would have spent in the classroom practicing your core discipline. Just Blaze's internship at The Cutting Room proved to be the perfect institution of higher learning for a budding producer in the rap game. The skills he picked up being a jack of all trades in the studio would become his calling card as his career exploded in the early aughts, giving him the craftsmanship and wherewithal to become one of the most prolific and successful producers during a classic era of New York rap. Of course, Just's most famous work from that period happened with Jay-Z and Dame Dash's Rockefeller Records. In a roughly 3-year span, from 2000 to 2003, Just would make significant contributions to a series of albums and artists that would define an era, from Jay-Z to Beanie Siegel to Freeway and Dipset. I wanted to pick his brain about what it was like being in the rock during such an extraordinary run, but first I was curious about how he was able to craft such a diverse body of work.
Where were you in terms of, like, were you all lawyered up and paperwork all taken care of, business?
No, the thing that was happening at the time was, like, Kuda was trying to sign me to his production company. At the time, he had Mace, Harlem World, the group, and then he also had this new group, the St. Lunatics, right? And this kid Nelly that he thought was going to be the breakout, or he didn't think, he knew was going to be the breakout star. So they were trying to sign me to Noise World as well. Me having grown up hearing so many horror stories about people getting jerked, or also having the, I guess you would call it, the gift of having interned in a studio, right? This is an era of fax machines. So me being the anything guy, like I said, just the general assistant. One day I'm in engineering sessions, the next day I'm getting faxes and delegating or bringing them to whoever they were intended for. But I'm seeing recording contracts that would be sent to the studio for a producer to look over or sign or whatever. And I would see, I won't name names, but like I would see like contracts coming in from a label and it would be like, oh, the production company is getting $50,000 for the song to be produced. The actual producer is getting 10. Like, and I remember being like my one big thing was I'm never signing to anybody. You know, I never really fully got compensated. But I, it's one of those things where I expected.
Yeah.
And it's not that they didn't give me anything. I just didn't get everything I was entitled to. But I got the experience, and that was the most important part. And I got the name out. And that led to, I think from there, that led to me working with Half a Mil, who was on Penalty at the time, because Penalty used to book all the time for Nori stuff when they were working on Nori's first
album. Okay.
So I knew Mayhem, and Gino was Mayhem's assistant, and Martin was around at the time as well, Martin Moore. So, like, that led to me working on Half a Mil, rest in peace, which led to Big Pun and so many other things. But it was like, from that point on, like, right after the May situation, we had everything on up legally and management-wise, and companies were formed and whatnot. But, yeah, like, I wasn't prepared. Because, again, up until that point, I was getting ready to leave. Like, I was ready to go back to school. So I didn't have the infrastructure in place right away.
You grew up in this sort of boom-bap era of hip-hop. But you come into the game with this very prototypical shiny suit moment. And then even over the next few years, like, you had placements, Who Want What, that sort of sounded very of the Triton era.
Right.
Where were you in terms of feeling like you had found your voice or what you wanted to express through the music?
I actually took pride in the fact that, like, I could make anything. I never wanted to be pigeonholed. My thing was just, I love music, right? So, like, I grew up on just as much hip-hop as I did house and electro and so many other genres of music. So, for me, it was just get into where I fit in, and I just happened to be able to fit in a lot of places. I think that was ultimately a large part of my success, was that when artists would come to me, they never really knew what they were going to get. A lot of times in that era especially, I would make the beats on the spot. So, like, they'd book a session, or label would book a session. The artist would come through, and I would just cook up right then and there. And if that didn't work out, I would have a stash to pull from. But it was a lot of it was just very spontaneous. Like, all right, how are we feeling today? You know what I mean? And we would just go wherever the music took us.
That period from getting those very first placements until you got an in-house role with Rockefeller.
Right.
What was the process like back then for a producer shopping beats?
It was very few times that I went like to a label and actually shopped beats. One of the few times that I did that is how I ended up linking with Rockefeller, going and sitting with Dino and playing him music. And then G. Roberson just happening to have a meeting with Dino a week later with an artist who didn't have, Bathgate didn't have a demo. He would just rhyme live, but Dino wanted to hear him on music instead of just a cappella. So he happened to have my beat CD sitting there and played that. And that's what led to G coming to look for me at the Cutting Room. So in the beginning, yeah, it was like going to a label or artist might be in a session and they'd ask you to come by and play some music. But things took off for me relatively quickly. Like, it was a slow beginning, but once things took off, it took off, right? So I was able to eventually come into a situation where there was enough confidence in me, industry-wise, where I would get paid before I ever made a beat or went into the studio. We were able to set it up where it was like, all right, this is my fee. You give me the first half, I come into the studio and make something. It wasn't an ego thing where it was like, you got to pay me to even get in a room with you. It was, we had so much happening, there were so many calls, it was like, if you want my time, you kind of got to pay for it. However, we're not leaving the room until everybody's satisfied. So it wasn't like, it was never a thing where it was like, I make it and you get what you got and deal with it or don't deal with it. It was never that. It was always, all right, now that we're in, label would pay the fee, now that we're in the room, what do we make? You know what I mean? By the time I got to Rockefeller, we ended up doing a situation where it was like, they had that same confidence. When G heard my tape from Dino, he reaches out and he's like, listen, this is a twofold thing. Like, me and hip hop, Hop was the other A&R, yes. Rockefeller. Me and Hop have this artist, Bathgate. We'd love to get you in with him. We also are starting a production team. We had the idea to start a production team for Rockefellers. They wanted it to be me, Rock Wilder, K-Rob, Buck Wild, and Kanye. And the production team itself never like really officially took place, but I mean, for all intents and purposes, the crew was the crew. So it was very much like from the jump, they were like, yo, we want you for Bathgate, but we also want you to get down with Rockefeller in general. And they basically like, off from the very beginning, like put me in with Bath, put me in control of his budget. With Rockefeller, it was kind of like a touch and go thing. So like they had me in with the mill immediately, engineering and kind of helping with songs. Like I like beats that other producers had did. I don't want to say ghost executive produced the album, but I was, I guess, co-exec. Like the three people that were in every session that made every creative decision ultimately were me, G, and Amel. That led to me eventually being taken seriously by Jay and getting in the room with Beans and Bleak and everybody else. Once it got to that point, Jay gave me the beat room at Baseline and we did a deal off top where it was like, they weren't trying to lock me down. I wasn't trying to be locked down. I was vocal about that, but they gave me a very large amount of money up front. And what they would basically do is, this number covers this many beats. And if you have up front and as artists use beats and deals get closed, we just give you a back end for each one, right? So like I end up doing 5 records on a Beans album, I get a back end for that. I end up doing 3 records on a Bleak album, I get a back end for those. And that was really the extent of our deal. It was never like a first right of refusal or whatever. When you have arguably at that point the biggest label the biggest label in hip hop and some of the best talent, There's really no need to go run around and, you know what I mean? Like, there doesn't need to be a bunch of protections in place because it's like, where else you gonna go? You know what I mean? Like, you're already playing with the winning team. But having the deal structured that way allowed me to go out and still do records with whoever else.
It was interesting because for those first four albums, Jay was very pointed in like having very discreet sounds and discreet production teams for right. each album had its own, you know,
right.
like, okay, this one, he's got Swizz.
Right.
This one's the Hitman. This right. one, it's Timberland.
Right.
And then the Dynasty happens and this sort of consortium forms.
Right.
And it really felt like the whole thing both coalesced, but it also changed in a real way once that happened. Because all of you guys all sort of found that common ground sonically.
Right.
And it went from being Jay-Z rhymes on what's hot to there's a Rockefeller sound.
Right. We're now dictating the sound and we're dictating what's hot. No, that's very true. But again, that goes back to the vision that G and Hop had, which was up until that point, they're just getting beats from whoever's rocking. You know what I mean? Or whoever's hot at the time. And it went from that to let's get our own team and develop our own sound. I guess, yeah, you're right. Up until that point, there wasn't really a Rockefeller sound. Producers that he worked with extensively had a certain sound. Obviously, Tim had a sound. Clark had a sound. Ski had a sound.
Yeah, it bled between albums a little bit, but
right. But it was really when the Dynasty out. I always say we started figuring it out on the Dynasty, really nailed it on Bean's second album.
I slept on yeah. classic.
Like nailed it on Bean's second album, and then perfected it on the Blueprint. But really, the Blueprint is really sonically is very much like the perfection of what we started on being second album.
And was there a feeling internally once you guys finished the Blueprint, like, this is it?
This is going to sound cliche, but you never know that you're making history when you're making it. So as good as we knew it was, can't speak for anybody else, but for myself, it was kind of like, all right, we got that done, what's next? You know what I mean? So there wasn't really a lot of time for reflection for me personally at Rockefeller, because at any given moment, I might be working on literally like 12 songs at once, right? Like, I got Beans in one room, I got Bleak in another, I got Freeway writing in the office, Jay's writing here. So it was just kind of like just Dipset showing up. So it was like, it was just always nonstop. So there wasn't really a lot of time for me personally for reflection. You gotta remember, the Blueprint happens so fast. People always think it's like an urban legend or myth that the album was done in 3 days, but the vast majority of it was Jay walked in on a Friday, like, anybody got some beats? Or Josh, you got some beats? Like, you got a CD from me? Yeah. All right, cool. Like, and he wasn't scheduled to record, so I had nothing in the stash for him. So it was like me going through the hard drive and pulling out what I found there. I think I maybe made Song Cry specifically for the Blueprint, but Girls, 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 the beat had been done. Everybody knows that I made that for Ghostface originally. You Don't Know had been done. You Don't Know might have been a year old already. Prodigy might have been the first one to hear it. A lot of people don't know. Me and P used to hang out a lot.
And you had beats on the
On the HNIC album. But like even before that, like I said, like going back to the Cutting Room era, I still don't have a lot of rap friends, right? Like P was one of the few. Like P would actually come to the house and like we'd cook dinner and just hang out, right? And it was wild because then Al ended up moving around the corner from me. This is downtown, all the way like by the seaport. So like Al literally lived on one corner, Al lived on the same block, just like right around the corner. So like me and P would be somewhere, he'd drop me off, go hang out by Al, come back around by my crib when he was done with Al. So like P was probably the first person to hear it. But it wasn't even a thing where I was trying to shop it to him. Like he would just be around when I would make beats, right? Then I will say the first iteration of it, I don't remember how it came about, but You Don't Know was at one point going to be Busta and Prodigy. Like, and neither one of them actually ever laid anything, but I remember that being the conversation. So I played it for Bus at Soundtrack. And if you remember New York Studio History, Soundtrack was Violator heavy. So like there would be a lot of times when Busta would be in one room and Mobb Deep would be in the next. And they were both studio rats, just like me. So we'd be in there all night, all day and night long every night. like basically if I wasn't at Baseline, I was usually at Soundtrack with them. So, You Don't Know had been done. Song Cry I made specifically for Jay when he came in. So I want to say, like, if he came in with the CD from Ye, with the four beats from Ye, I think I gave him You Don't Know, gave him Girls, 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 and then made Song Cry, like, the second night after he had finished recording whatever he was recording that day. And then he recorded that the third day. There was another record that I did on them. Now that I think about it, Lyrical Exercise, literally, might have been the last thing he did for the Blueprint, because he kept coming back to it for whatever reason. He would get stuck on the rhyme. Like, he had, like, maybe a verse or, like, a half in the first verse, and for whatever reason, he just couldn't catch it. So he was like, whatever, scrap it. And the reason it ended up as a bonus is because at the very last minute, he's like, yo, I got the rhyme. Went in and nailed it, but the album was already sequenced and whatnot. We wanted to use it, so we just tagged as a bonus.
With Michael Jackson on Girls, Girls, Girls.
So Michael Jackson is on the Girls, Girls, Girls remix, the Ye version. And I never knew that. I don't know if I didn't go to the studio that day. I don't know how I missed it, you know. And people have always asked about it. It's come up in interviews, and I've always taken the position of, like, I don't know what you're talking about. Where does this even come from? I thought it was an urban legend or something that Jay said, like, in jest one day, or just was some kind of a myth. And then when it comes to the Baseline era, like, I'm the archivist, right? I was the one who kept everything. Every session, every beat tape, anything that was ever recorded or even submitted to Baseline, like, I have records of. I have it. So one day I was looking for something on the server, and I find these stray... This stray folder that says MJ vocals. And I'm like, MJ, don't know that, Michael Jackson, whatever. And I'm thinking it's probably stuff from, remember Jay had the, or remember they had the Rock My World?
Yep.
So I'm thinking it's like takes from that session. And I'm like, I don't think they recorded this at Baseline, but let me take a listen and see what it is. And I realize, as I'm listening to it, it's him singing on Girls, Girls, Girls. And I'm like, it's true. Like, I never, the last 20 years, I found it, like, during quarantine.
That's crazy.
So all these years, I'd never known it was actually a real thing. And turns out the files have been sitting downstairs this entire time.
One of the things that I've always been impressed by in your career and I think is pretty unique and extraordinary is you've always been very conscious about branding. And right. I think this is something that probably kids watching this will not remember, but like you first came on my radar, obviously for these first few placements that you get, but then the two-way programming
right.
of the beats.
Right.
Like two ways for anyone that's watching this, it was like before smartphones.
Right.
You could get melodies and just was the architect of a lot of these remaking right. hip-hop beats.
So it was like ringtone. Basically, it was ringtones before ringtones, right? So a two-way was a device that we used to be able to use to text each other, essentially, if you put it in a nutshell, right? And there was no such thing as a ringtone back then. It was just your phone just rang or your two-way just beeped. But they had a very rudimentary application in them that allowed you to program your own ringtones through a series of notes and vibrations. Like you could program the vibrator. So it was, I basically figured out how to program this. Cause it wasn't like a thing where like you didn't make, like it wasn't like you used the keys as a drum pad. It was all math. It was literally 100% math. So if you weren't good with numbers, you weren't gonna be able to do this. And somehow I figured out how to do it. And and then what I would do is I would make them, and then like it was only a handful of us that even had two ways, right? At the time, it was like me, Hove, Clue, Duro, Nori. It was maybe like literally like 20 of us, G Hop, like Skane. Like, so I would just send them out and they would circulate amongst the crew. And then as a little bit of time passed, two ways became more ubiquitous and they became a thing that everybody had for a while. So my ringtones would be everywhere. And what I would do, I was always conscious, like, of when I would make a ringtone, I would put my name on it. So there were a lot of people within the business, and even regular people as time went on, who first became aware of my name from making two-way ringtones before they even knew me for my actual music, to the point where, like, there were a couple of articles I remember that were written about me, where they would, like, state, like, he came into the game making two-way beats, and now he's making beats for it. And I'm like, no, that's, like, or what, there was one article that I think said, I learned to make beats by making two-way alerts. And I was like, oh, my God. It's like the modern-day equivalent of, like I said, of somebody, like, coming to an interview when their prep work was reading your Wikipedia page. But, yeah, no, that was the going back to what you were saying about branding, that was a very conscious decision. You know what I mean? Like, because I was never the type to do, like, the Pharrell thing or the Dre thing or the Ye thing, like, coming out as an artist, right? Like, I was always just the producer. So for me, it was always just one of the key things was always just, how do I position my name? You know what I mean? That was the same thing with the Just Blaze drop.
Which I was going to say, which then leads to you being a pioneer.
Right.
I know, I understand there's some dispute between you and Rashad.
No, it's not a dispute. So Rashad, like, this conversation has actually happened amongst producers. Like, who was the first one of us to do it? So generally the consensus is, in terms of an identifiable vocal drop, people were like, it was Just. But then I'm like, well, wait a minute. I was the one who was like, technically, Rashad had the dice roll sound, right? The question is, does that count? Because it's not like an audible phrase, right? So it's like, outside of DJ and producer nerds, it wasn't like something that was vocally said, right?
No, and even as a fairly hardcore consumer,
right?
It was very subtle.
Like, right. So it's more so like, but then you have, so there's that, then you have like, Pete used to do his ad-libs, right?
Yes.
On records. And Puff used to do his ad-libs on records. But then it's like, all right, but none of those are just standard, like, this is my name tag or this is my drop. So I think I've never been the person to say I was the first one to do it. You know, it's been something that's been said. It was a very intentional thing. It started out as just trying to get a shout out from rappers on records, right? It was really just like a way to get your name popping or whatever. People just to know that you exist. But ultimately, I just wanted people to know that I existed, right? Because as a producer, generally, your shelf life is limited. You have your run, you're in, you're out. And most producers will get like a two-year run. Very few of us have a career, right? So for me, it was just trying to get shouted out on records. And that's what used to happen. Like, funny enough, like sometimes rappers would shout me out on records, even if it wasn't my record, like, because I might have been engineering the session. And I would have to say, like, you should take my name out, because the actual producer might have a problem with another producer being shouted out on his record. That was me just being conscious of, like when I want somebody else getting shouted out on my record, the shout out itself wouldn't bother me, but somebody else, a consumer hearing the record and thinking that somebody else did it, I just didn't like the idea. So I asked rappers for shout outs, or sometimes they would just do it, because I forget who said this recently. They were like, it's a lot of times you hear like artists ad lib get the top of the record. It's just nervous rapper energy. You know what I mean? Like, they're just trying to figure out what to say or how to start it or whatever, or they don't know what to do. So they just start shouting out producers and their people that are in the room with them. I don't remember who. Mill, Exhibit, Killer Priest, whoever I was working with would just say my name at the top of a record. Cam had done it, you know. But it was always different and random, right? I realized that eventually realized that listeners or consumers or whoever kind of just didn't realize Just Blaze was a person. They thought it was just something that rappers were saying at the beginning of songs.
Like just some slang.
Right, yeah. It's the slang of the month, right? So then I'm like, all right, I don't know what I can really do about that. So it changes, or it comes about in the Joe Budden Pump It Up session, where he didn't shout me on a record. I asked him if he could. He was like, what you want me to do it for? Do it yourself. And I'm like, I'm gonna shout myself out. He's like, well, I'm not doing what you have to do. Right. So I'm like, all right. So I remember that session just being full of a bunch of jokes. So I remember I was, for whatever reason, I don't remember what the specific joke was, but I mean, I told my story a million times where I'm cracking on him, you know, in reference to his line on Focus, his first single, where he's like, Mondays, Fridays, Saturdays. So I went in the booth and I was like, just please. And ha ha ha, whatever, left it, you know, and it worked. You know, but I think the reason why it worked is because I placed it on the song in a way where I placed it on the song rhythmically. So when DJs would play it and they'd be backspinning the intro, I've always kind of tried to design records to be performed at shows or played by DJs, right? So the way that record builds up, DJs would be bringing back, cutting up the intro and backspinning the intro. And because of the way the Just Blaze, the way it fell, people would end up backspinning that part a bunch. So the placement of it on that record and all the records I put it on afterward is really what led to it being drilled into people's heads, because it was always just done rhythmically. It was very intentional and very deliberate. It wasn't like, oh, just put my name anywhere randomly on the record. I think, speaking of the drop, I think my one regret is not putting it on What We Do. I didn't have the Just Blaze drop didn't exist yet, but Free used to always say my name on records. And the records that I knew were gonna be big, or that I had a feeling would be big, even if he didn't say it, I would put it on there. So like the Just Blaze that's on the flip side is not, he didn't say that. Like I took it from another him saying it somewhere else and placed it there because I knew flip side was gonna be big. What We Do was in a lot of ways so much of an afterthought. And the funny thing about my Wikipedia is there's so much inaccuracy or just inaccurate information on it. So to this day, like, I can always tell because one of the first things on there is that the name Just Blaze came from a video game character, and which is totally not true. But so whenever somebody says, so you named yourself after Blaze Fielding from Streets of Rage, and I'm like, Wikipedia, you have to do better than that.
Where did the name come from?
Came about during the May sessions, actually. During the May sessions, though. I think, I'm not 100% sure, but it was between Super Sam, like I said, it was Kuda's partner, and rest in peace, Huddy Combs, Huddy Six. They were like, oh, you gotta come up with a name. And like I said, I didn't even have a name, I was just DJ Just. And they're like, you can't just be Just, like, you gotta be something better than that. So, during one of the sessions, I forget which song we were recording. I think we were recording, it was a record we ended up never putting out. But I remember, I was tracking the beat. This might have been the night, I forget who he was going at, but it might have been Cam. Mace had a record called I'm No Killer or something like that. Like, I'm no killer, but don't make me one. I'm no thug, but don't make me one. I forget. He was going at somebody. It might have been Cam, I don't remember. But it was the same night that record premiered. Like, I don't know, Flex or somebody was okay. Played it. And I was tracking this beat. They were going to do a record with Foxy. Foxy was going to get on it. And I remember they were like, I think it was Sam was like, yo, your name should be Just Hot. And I was like, I'm not naming myself Just Hot. And then I think they kept calling me that like as a joke. They were messing with me. And then I think HUD came in the room a little while later, because HUD was around for a lot of those sessions. And he came in the room and was like, yo, who did that beat? And they're like, over there. He was like, oh, that beat is Just, it's Just Blazing. And he didn't even know my name was Just. He was just like, oh, that beat is Just, it's Just, it's Blazing. They were like, that's your name, Just Blaze. And I was like, hell no. But I never came up with a better name. So when the I Really Like It record came out, they put produced by Just Blaze. So I just ran with it. And I was gonna change it. And then the record ended up going gold and doing well. So I just kind of was like, all right, well, I'd kind of be silly to change it now. But yeah, that's where it came from.
So after you guys do Blueprint, and this is when I would say like peak Rockefeller starts, right. And all of a sudden they now have a suite of artists.
Right.
You have a room in Baseline.
Right.
And you're churning out records at an extremely high volume.
Right.
What was your life like in that moment?
What was my life like during that time? Hectic.
Are you sleeping in the studio? Are you going home?
I'm really not sleeping. Like, because at this point, Baseline is legit a factory, right? So everybody has their times in which they work, right? So Bleak is an early bird, right? So he's at the studio by like 11 a.m., 10 a.m. Hove is getting there 1:30-ish, 1:30, 2 o'clock-ish, right? Other artists are filling in between. Once you get to the era where Dipset's around, they're getting there around 7. Beans is getting there at 4 in the morning. After telling you that he was on his way at 8 p.m., he's finally getting there at 4 in the morning, passing out, and then waking up at 6 a.m., like, let's go. You know what I mean? So it was me holding down a lot of the production duties for all these artists. There really was no time for anything else in between. You slept when you could. But yeah, like me, Goo, Hop, Shane, Dave, like we basically lived at Baseline. We'd go home to take showers and maybe spend a little time with our significant others or whatever and be right back to it.
And so that was, I would imagine, a very intense 2 or 3 years that this is going on.
Yeah.
What was the wind down like? The sort of rupture in the relationship with Dame and Jay's?
Right.
Well documented at this point.
Right.
But being in the middle of that as it's happening, what is that energy like, and how cognizant of these changes are you sort of day to day, week to week?
I mean, you could definitely see the change in the energy. You could see the change in the dynamic. There were all of a sudden a lot more closed door meetings than there ever used to be. A lot of things that I've never spoken on and I wouldn't, but I remember when a line was drawn for me, like personally, or when it was addressed to me personally, you know, because at one point me and Dame had like an actual issue, and Jay got wind of what was happening, pulled me to the side and asked me what was going on. So I told him, and like that conversation is when I actually understood, oh yeah, this
was
is
this a interpersonal issue or a business issue?
It was a business issue that became a personal issue. I remember, you know, I guess Jay got wind of what was happening, pulled me to the side, we talked about it. And it's not like he said something specifically to me in regards to like there's a breakup coming. It wasn't anything like that. But just the nature of the conversation, the way the conversation happened and the way it took place, I was just like, oh yeah, all right, this is about to be over. You could just tell from the nature of the conversation. And it was, I think, the everybody's kind of trying to figure out what their next move might be or like who's going. I think with the artist, it was more so a matter of who's going to side with who, right? That wasn't really a factor or an issue for me. It was more so just, I think the thing that was that, let me put this the right way. There was so much more work to do. There was so much more that could have been done. Other artists that were coming into the fold, like the MOP thing never got to happen. That was something that I was really excited for. But other artists, there was just other artists and other possibilities. But the way the business was growing, it was just the way the opportunities were going for everybody. Me and Biggs were cool now. Me and Dame were cool now. I remember one of the last conversations that we had as a group, right? It was the day that Ye brought Quali's Just to Get By over. We were doing a photo shoot. I forget what the shoot was for. But this was kind of like my last fond memory of Rockefeller as a unit. Interestingly enough, was Ye had brought that by that day. And funny enough, just thinking about more to do, right? Like I'm saying about so much more to do or that could be done. Like, that was the first time. And they brought up to me, like, should we do a Just Blaze Rockefeller album? You know, and I was the one that was like, I was always leery about that. Like, I was always a little, I guess, insecure about being put on Front Street like that or being a front man of something. I was cool playing the majority background. But they were like, nah, like, you're like our Dr. Dre. We need to, Dr. Dre got to where he got to by making his albums. Like, he did N.W.A. and all that, then he went and did The Chronic. You got to do your Chronic. So let's figure that out. And I was just like, all right, cool. You know, and shortly after that, when everything fell apart. Had we not split, I don't know that I would have went forward with it. But I guess in retrospect, it wouldn't have been that hard because we were sitting on so much material anyway, right? It probably would have been just a matter of finding the right set of songs, fine-tuning them, packaging it the right way, and doing whatever. The same way they used to do with Clue with The Professional. Like, so I can't say it's unfortunate that that never happened. It might have been cool to see. But yeah, ironically, that is my last memory. Well, that was the last time that we all hung out and like were in good candor and good conversation.
Today's episode of the Idea Generation podcast is brought to you by Tres Generaciones Tequila. At its heart, Idea Generation is about the triumph of creative visionaries. But as anyone that's listened to the pod before knows, success always comes in the face of adversity. However, while the conditions creatives operate in may not be perfect, your tequila can be. Tres has a rich history dating back to its founding in 1973, which helps explain why the brand is a champion of those who persevere. The best value props are often the simplest, and Tres Generaciones is as straightforward as they come. Made from 100% blue agave and water sourced from an ancient aquifer beneath the tequila volcano, Tres is triple distilled for unrivaled smoothness. So whether you're already at the top of your game or just setting out on your creative voyage, let Tres be your running partner on this journey. Tres Generaciones, for those ready to fail twice and get up Tres. It's still amazing to look back and think about the peak Rockefeller era and how big it felt and how relatively short it actually was. And yes, what could have been? A front-to-back Just Blaze album from 2003? It could have been Chef's Kiss. If anything, though, the fracturing of the Rockefeller crew opened up a wide variety of new opportunities for Just, ones that played to his strengths as a nimble collaborator. For a time in the late aughts and early teens, he was closely associated with two highly regarded artists, Saigon and J Electronica. For a variety of non-Just Blaze-related reasons, neither of those two projects would ever achieve their true potential. Just also ended up owning and running Baseline Studios for about a decade, serving as a caretaker to the place where some of the greatest music of all time was cut. But it's Just's work in the video game space that was most interesting to me, as it represents a full circle moment for a kid who grew up obsessed with computers. I'd learned that he'd been scoring soundtracks for a host of huge games in the early aughts, but it's his work with Brass Lion Entertainment that has the potential for the most impact. Brass Lion's goal is to provide a storytelling platform for black and brown voices in the video game space, and they've got the right executive suite, including Just himself, to see it through.
So, with Rockefeller dissolving, it puts you in an interesting moment of inflection in your career. You are well established with dozens of classic records under your belt.
Right.
Probably fairly secure financially, I would imagine.
Right.
Did you have a game plan or a strategy for what was going to come next?
No, I had some ideas, but I didn't have an actual straight-up game plan. Like, by that point, I had owned Baseline, right? So it was like, all right, we own the studio. The problem with that is everybody views Baseline as a private space, right? Because Rockefeller basically had it locked down for years. So it was never really on the radar of labels because people just assume, well, you can't book Baseline. Like, if you're not Def Jam, if you're not Rockefeller, you can't book Baseline. And it took me a long time to be like, no, actually, you can. You know what I mean? Like, so there was that. And then I was still very busy producing, obviously. But that, I think for me, the next phase was like, all right, cool. Well, let's try, I guess, do a label or do some kind of a, let's find some artists or something, which leads to the Saigon era and doing that deal with Atlantic, because once Rockefeller was over, G and Hop went to Atlantic. So that was the easy. Craig was already interested, but G and Hop being there just made it an easy no-brainer, or so it seemed like at the time. So that, aside from producing for whoever else I was producing for at the time, like, Saigon became the big focus for a while. Obviously that went the way that it went.
I was going to say, it felt like in that period, there was a real aspiration on your part to make a body of work with someone, and kind of between Saigon and Jay Alec back to back for a litany of unconnected and random reasons.
Right.
Neither sort of congealed into what one got the feeling you were aspiring toward.
It's funny. I was never really looking to make a body work per se, right?
Okay.
Like, but I understand why you would say that. And a lot, that's, I used to see that sentiment a lot from people. Like, because a lot of people would feel like, oh, the only reason Just isn't mentioned in the name in the same breath as certain other producers is because he hasn't made a total body of work. And I'm like, it's funny that was on people's minds more than it was actually on mine. I never really 100% agreed with that sentiment. Like, to me, the amount of work that I have done in so many albums where I was a large part or the anchor of the album, a lot of that work was so good. I'm like, I'm not really worried about it. Like, I don't have to be the start to finish guy. You know what I mean? If it happens, it happens. Cool. But for me, it was just like, let's just put out dope music. Because, like, even on the Saigon album, like, I didn't do every beat. And that was always my thing. Like, for me, with the whole body of work thing, it was really like, and this is something that's been discussed by a few people, right? But, like, when it came to working at Baseline, one of the rules was you check your ego at the door. And not everybody was able to do that. But in general,
I was going
to
say, that's a tall order with that cast of characters.
Right. But Jay's thing was always, we do what's best for the record. There's uncredited overdubs on so many records. Like, there's records on the Blueprint that were touched by other producers, like, that aren't credited. It was just, this is what the record needed, right? And because it's uncredited, I wouldn't go into who did what. But
it was a team effort.
Right. It was very much a team effort. And that trickled down to everything, even on records that I didn't technically produce. Jay would be like, yo, I need this to sound like this. Just can you do that or add that, right? Or the majority of Freeway's album was really just B, Goo, and Freeway in the room. Like, and even on records that I didn't produce, like, I'm still working on the mix, or I'm still picking beats with Free. You know what I mean? Like, sequencing songs that had nothing to do with, or it might have been a record I didn't touch, but it's like, where does this go? You know, it was very much a team effort. So for me, that's like, when it comes to a body of work, there's always so many other, there's a whole other cast of characters that people don't even know played a part. So, like, being the sole producer on an album was never so much a concern for me as it was, like, what is the end result? What's best for the record, as Jay Alec used to say. You know, so that's always been my thing. That's probably why I was never really pressed to do the Just Blaze album or to, like, be known as the sole producer of something. I just wanted to make good music and be a part of good music. Like I said earlier, the Emil album, there's a ton that I've done that wasn't credited, and I don't need to be. It's just ultimately, I helped her put her best foot forward, and we made something dope.
In that era, also, sounds start to shift. The attention, the gravity of hip-hop moves to the South a bit.
Right.
And I'm curious, how did your relationship with the music start to change? I ask this as a kid who grew up obsessed with it, and then you get to be in it, and then you get to be at the heart of the most exciting thing that's happening.
Right.
And you have all the accolades and everything that comes with it. Mm-hmm. Did your ambition or the thing that make you happy about it start to shift in that period?
I never operated from a standpoint of ego or fear, but I was always very cognizant of the fact that it could all be over tomorrow, right? Like I said, growing up in the cutting room and seeing producers' contracts, or like seeing producers at the height of their career or of their powers, but then seeing them on the end.
You told an anecdote once about running into Pal Joey, who is an icon of the dance scene and also did Material Love, which is probably a top five hip-hop record of all time.
Right.
and seeing him in not the best space later in life.
Well, so, like, yes and no. And the reason why I say no is because, like, was Joby still churning out hot musics and dances and Love's Gonna Get Yous and Duck Downs at that point in his career or life? No, but he had the sense and the awareness to go get a job that would still keep him in the mix of the culture, right? Like, he ended up taking a job at a Unique Recording Studios. And remember how I was saying before? Like, when there's a run or an artist or an album that to you just seems so impactful, and then you look back decades later, you're like, well, that was really just a year, or that was really just one album, you know, or it was actually a relatively short run. I think my surprise, it wasn't so much that Joey was in a bad place in his life. It was because he was so influential to me, right? You have your hero. And you think, look at all these records on these walls, right? Pretty much everything in here is impactful to culturally or musically somehow. The majority of these artists never made a lot of money, right? But because they're so influential, or because they've had impacts on so many people, or on culture or on people, in your mind, especially when you're younger, you feel like everybody who made something that influenced you, they're all rich, they're all famous, they're all living on a hill somewhere. It's like, no, they're just regular people just like us, right? So I think for me, it was more so the surprise of seeing Joey working an engineer job and being like, but why would you ever have to do this? You should be. And then you get older and you realize, hey, life happens, right? And I remember asking him, what are you doing working here? And in retrospect, like, that might have come off really bad, but it was because of my admiration for him, right? Like, I just felt like that was something that he should have been above, but in reality, he wasn't. But the great thing about that convo was I remember saying to him, like, again, being a stupid kid, like, and not really understanding tact, I guess, in that moment, I remember asking him if he'd gotten paid for the thong song. And for those of you people who don't realize, like, one of Joey's biggest records was Dance by the Earth People. Or it was his record, but it was he did it under the artist name Earth People. It was Dance. It was a huge, huge house hit, the classic. Like, there's hot music, and then there's just his seminal record, and then there's Dance, right? The thong song sampled the Bonus Beats version of Dance. So I was like, yo, you got to clear the sample with you, whatever. And he looks at me, he's like, you think I can actually get money for that? And I'm like, dude, yes. And I remember seeing him again like a week later, and I don't know what the total outcome ended up being, but I remember seeing him again and being like, yo, thanks for that. I went and spoke to him about the issue. Just seeing him in that next phase of his career and him immersing himself back in the studio life as an engineer, or growing up in the cutting room and seeing a lot of producers at their height of their powers, and then at the not so height of their powers, where, like, I've even seen dudes who were like, book sessions because they were scrambling to hurry up and get X amount of records done so they could renew their publishing deal because they needed that next check, right? And these were dudes who 3 years before were whipping around in Ferraris and Lamborghinis. I was always very cognizant of the ups and downs. Like I said, I didn't operate from a standpoint of fear or ego, but from a place of reality. You know what I mean? Because I've seen a lot of ups and downs personally, you know, close and personal. So at a certain point, it was just like, okay, the name is established. The history is there. The discography is there. How do we start to leverage this outside of sitting in a studio 20 hours a day making music? Because that's not always going to be feasible, sustainable, or possible.
Right? Let's say, were you also just sort of physically spent at that?
I guess you could say I was a bit tired. Like I said, I had permanent bags under my eyes, right? So definitely physically spent a bit, but just also more so, like, there's the one thing about being in the business where there's the constant hustle to keep up, stay updated, stay fresh. And at a certain point, it's just like, you look, for example, you look at people with money, and the thing is always, how do you make your money work for you? So eventually you don't have to work. You know what I mean? And for me, it was kind of just, how do I get on that path? You know, like there has to be more to this than just making beats for people. So that was part of the drive behind the Saigon thing or the J Electronica thing. Like, how do we go past just making beats? That's what led me to start doing like scoring work, like a bunch of the game scores that I did. It was just, from a financial standpoint, I made more money doing like one or two games.
Which games did you do?
I did NBA Street Volume 2, which is widely considered a classic of that era. I also did NBA Live 2003, which was in the basketball world because NBA 2K had kind of been eating their lunch a bit.
Yep.
And then it was NBA Ballers. I did a lot of basketball games, NBA Ballers. Then because I was in the EA Sports ecosystem, I would allow them to relicense things for other titles. So like Madden, MLB, Tiger Woods, etc. Fast forward a bit later, Street Fighter 4, I did all the scores for the scoring for the commercials. Same for Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Out of the Shadows. There's a couple more that I'm forgetting. But that wasn't like stuff where it was like, oh, they're just licensing a song of mine that's pre-existing. It was, hey, I want you to come in and actually score this like a movie, you know?
Was that work creatively exciting? Was it a fun challenge?
It was definitely exciting because it's like, you're not operating within the confines of bars, hooks, verses. It's just, how do we take what's happening on screen and amplify it or make it that much more exciting? How do we allow the visual to inform the audio, right? Because most times you're dealing with music or making records, the visual is the last part of the equation, like if they're shooting a video, right? In this case, the things are being created in tandem. So as they're building the game, I'm watching it and I'm getting advanced copies of it and scoring to picture, basically. But it was interesting because it's like scoring a movie, it's very linear, right? So it's like, this is what happens on screen and you make something to go along with that. When you're doing a game, it's interactive. So there's constant movement and it can constantly change. Like a player may do this here, he may do this. You play the game again, he's going to do something else a different way. You know what I mean? Especially in a sports game, there is no routine, there's no script, so to speak. So you're basically just writing interactive music for every possible moment. So it was a fun challenge. And like I was saying, financial, much different ball game than making records. Like, residuals might not necessarily be the same, just to the nature of how game structure works. But the upfront money was great. They also like put a lot of the commercial work in my hands. So like when they had to do commercials, they were like, yo, just send the commercials to Just, have them score those and arrange those as well. So it was definitely a fun exercise, but more importantly, it kind of was my first real exposure to controlling your brand and positioning myself in a medium outside of what I was known for.
You're doing this while you still have hardcore Just Blaze stands.
Right.
Arguably one in this room.
Right.
That still want
the music. Right.
PSA part 16, because that.
Right. It's tough because I've always been very, very engaged online, right? So, like, you'll see people say things like, oh, Just Blaze is dope, but he's lazy. He hasn't put out a record in 6 months. And it's like, well, that's because I'm doing 20 other things. You know what I mean? Or because I haven't done a whole album, but I must just be goofing off somewhere. Like, it's people will never understand the totality of what comes along with doing what we do as creatives in general, whether you're a graphic artist or a journalist or a musician. People just see what's right in front of them, you know? But there's a whole machine in a life that people have outside of these things. But yeah, and like I said, you can't just do the one thing forever. You know, I mean, you can. I can't think of anybody who's done just the one thing forever and been able to make a lifelong career out of it. Not saying it's not possible. I just don't know any examples of it.
One of the more interesting things that you did in that period is arguably probably highest quality piece of branded content ever in Exhibit A.
Oh, wow. Yeah. A lot of people realize that that was literally a Guitar Center ad. And again, when you're making history, you don't know it when you're in the process of it, right? Like, Guitar Center wanted to do a partnership. They wanted to give us the cover of the there at the Circular for that season. And they were like, hey, listen, why don't you guys do a record? We'll sponsor it and pay for it. We'll pay for all the expenses. And all right, great, no problem. There wasn't a big money exchange. It was just like, we will give you any piece of gear that you would ever want that is out right now. Which me being a gear nerd was amazing. Then we did the record, and the only way you could actually physically get it is if you went to Guitar Center, and you don't even think you had to buy something. I think you would just walk in, and there would be like the CDs would just be sitting at the cashier.
That's crazy.
And it's one of those things where I think I said it in Exhibit A or Exhibit C. I think I said things we do sometimes without even trying can be so impactful. You know, it was kind of the same story with Exhibit C. That was supposed to just be a promo for Ange, for Angela Yee, you know, and it ended up becoming a cultural phenomenon in that era.
I have to ask, I remember seeing footage on Not Right from Santos of Exhibit B being performed with Mos.
Yeah?
Maybe I'm making it up, but was there an Exhibit B?
Yeah, there is an Exhibit B with Mos. I feel like it's so funny that you mentioned that, because somebody literally just brought that up to me like within the last 2 days. I don't know why. I forget my context. But yes, there was an Exhibit B with Mos. Him and Jay at the time had an idea to do a duet project. I think they were going to call it Simpatico, if I'm not mistaken. And we cut like 4 songs. I think Exhibit B was the first thing we did. And then we cut like 3 other songs like over the course of like 2 days. And then as Jay and Mos both do, they disappeared. So the record is just sat. But there was an Exhibit B with Mos. I feel like the only like significant Jay Electronica thing that I remember from Santos wasn't a performance. It was like when Exhibit C was at the height of its powers, like 2 or 3 weeks in, and it's shutting the place down. Like it was like pure pandemonium. It was probably the closest thing I've ever had in my career to like a tunnel like experience. Like in that Funk Flex, Big Cap, Cypher Sounds are on the tunnel. I feel like that was probably my tunnel moment was that record. And then Jay maybe did come out and perform it then, like just randomly.
I feel like he did. I just remember some like blurry early cell phone footage.
Yeah, I think he did come out and perform it, and it was like, it was my equivalent of like X doing Get At Me Dog at the tunnel. It was wild.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
So as you're sort of thinking about diversifying your bonds and creating alternate revenue streams and also setting yourself up even outside of your core craft, music, what was your journey of discovery into entrepreneurship, and what were the first moves that you made?
I don't know if I could ever call it a journey. I kind of had the fortune of having some of the right people around me who helped me make some of the right decisions, right? As artists, as creatives, we don't have 401ks, we don't have retirement funds, we don't have pensions, we work for ourselves, right? So I remember like when I was living downtown, when I used to live right near Al, one of my neighbors who lived like the floor down from me was a junior account executive at Morgan Stanley. And even as a junior at the time, like he wasn't taking on accounts that were less than $500,000, which I didn't have at that moment, right? But I had like 60, and he was able to take me on and show me the ropes of investment, creating your own retirement plans and IRAs and things of that nature, kind of put me on the path to like, it's cool to have money and it's cool to save money, but save it in ways that make money for you. You know, and he put me on that path very early. That's why I say I was just fortunate to have people around who knew more than me in that regard. And then just even being around Jay, who was like one of rap's serial entrepreneurs early on, and like watching like the formation of the 40/40 Club, even, right? As they're going through the blueprints and designing the space and dealing with contractors and whatnot. I've been fortunate to be around so much of that and have people who would just freely offer advice. But then, like I said, also really just knowing that this can all be over at any given point. So it's like we have to find ways to diversify. So it was the investment in the stock market stuff, buying baselines. We had a helm of operations for whatever it was that we were going to do.
What was that like? Also, I mean, not to derail this, but just having to operate a studio.
Right.
I mean, obviously, you had the experience at Cutting Room, but
right. It was a lot, but it was one of those things where I got it at a very discounted rate for much less than it was worth in that era. And that was because, A, it was me, and people kind of felt like it was my house already. But also, when it was sold, it was, we know you'll take the legacy and continue it on, right? Like, there's other people that we can sell to more money for, but they're not going to respect the legacy, you know? So it was kind of almost one of those things where I had to buy it because it was entrusted to me, mm-hmm. you know? But it was a lot because up until that point, I had never been responsible for anybody but myself. Now you have a staff and bills and rent on a much different scale than I'd ever dealt with in my life before. But it was a good run. We, over the course of whatever it was, 12 years that it was open, never missed a rent payment, and nobody's paycheck ever bounced. But at a certain point, it was like, okay, the way records are being made has changed. Like, people are literally making records in their basements, on their phones, or on their laptops. It's not that big rooms aren't needed, they just aren't as needed. And with the way corporate real estate works, generally, especially in New York City, it's not like, you don't get month to month, you don't get year to year. It's like, all right, you got a 10-year lease, a 20-year lease, a 25-year lease. So we had a 10-year lease, and the lease was up. And because, like I said, because we never missed the rent, and there was never any incidents or any real issues at baseline, the building management was comfortable enough to let us go month to month for a while until I wanted to make a decision as to whether to renew or not renew. But like I said, just looking at the writing on the wall, it was like, listen, there will always be a need for studios, but the need for studios is changing as people adapt to new technology. And I'm like, we can continue now. Do we want this overhead 8 years from now? Probably not. So that's when we had to make the decision to shut it down. But it served its purpose.
So you were saying, as you start to build your sort of portfolio.
Right. So yeah, then it's like, all right, so then we do that. We start with the stocks, did the studio thing, which was an investment back in myself. I have a home base, a large-scale home base. Start dabbling in scoring. And then eventually dabble with the label thing. Obviously, that went the way it went. You're not going to win every time. But I think a lot of it for me was stocks, really. It wasn't probably until we did the Ani Ramen restaurants. I'm sure there's other things that I'm forgetting, but I know for me, that was the next big major thing.
So that, and it started as one restaurant in New York?
Well, the first location is in Montclair, second location is Jersey City. Now they're at like six locations.
That is a tough business.
Yeah, and especially going through the COVID era, through lockdowns and shutdowns and whatnot, we were able to pivot to a nonprofit. That's what helped us get through that. Any money that was made literally just went right back to just basically keeping the staff paid, and did a lot of service for first responders during that era. A lot of community work. We gave away, I don't know how many tens of thousands of meals. Well, because at first, like, you got to shut the restaurant down, but you have a zillion refrigerators full of food, it's gonna go bad. So it's just like, yo, turn the lemons to lemonade. And we just started feeding local families and people who were affected by the virus. But that community outreach and effort is what allowed us to stay open and weather that stuff. That's been going amazing. It's been great. It's been profitable at this point. You hear so many stories of people who invest in a restaurant and never get anything back, or have to wait 10 years to turn a profit. Like, we made our money back within the first, like, 2-3 years, which was amazing. You don't see that too often. But the thing about Ani, it was very intentional. We very much wanted to be a community cultural hub. Like, it's not just a place to come and sit down and have dinner and get out. That's the one thing we didn't want to do. Like, every other restaurant in that area, by 10 p.m., they're closed. You can get a full service, full meal from us. We close at 2, you show up at 1:45, you still get a meal. The music is curated specifically to lend to a cultural experience, not just random music. The vibe and the energy there, it's all very deliberate, you know what I mean? And I don't mean that in a disingenuous way. but like we just wanted to make sure that we delivered a very communal experience. And I think, well, I know for a fact that that's part of the reason why it's been so successful outside of the grief. You gotta have good food as well. But a lot of people, when it comes to restaurants or just social establishments, a lot of times people just take the attitude of build it and they'll come. That generally does not work. If you don't deliver a defined experience, people generally will not come because there's always somebody willing to give you a better experience. You know what I mean? So, I'm super, super proud of how well it's been doing.
Your most recent venture, which I know is still sort of somewhat under wraps,
right,
is kind of the confluence of your entire life's experience.
Indeed.
Can you tell me a little bit about...
Right. So my latest venture... I'm working very closely with Brassline Entertainment, which is a company founded by Brianna Smith, Vera Ayer, and Rashad Reddick. And I always refer to myself as like the unofficial fourth wheel because it was very much their vision. I just helped out at pivotal moments. In 2017, 18, it was just an idea to start a video game studio that was focused on storytelling for Black and brown voices and just marginalized groups in general. A lot of companies talk the diversity talk. Very few of them walk it. For them, it's more so a buzz term, something that they or something or an initiative they might have to do for now, right? So there'll be a bunch of Black and brown voices down here, or underrepresented voices down here, but if you get further up the food chain, they're not there. They're not making the decisions, they're not cutting the checks. But we wanted to be able to tell our stories in an interactive medium. And so, a few years ago, it was just three of them and me. And a little bit later on, a homie, Evan Narcisse, came on. He's written for Black Panther and a ton of other games as well, and a lot of comics. He's a legend in his own right, in his own lane. And quietly did the legwork. And now, as it stands right now, we are at a 59 staff full-time. My official role, like I said, is the director of music and culture. I basically am kind of like the connective tissue between the company and the culture that we represent. I cannot say much more than that, but what I can say is that I'm super proud of what the team has built so far. The mission statement in terms of just diversity and empowerment is a very real thing. And like you said, it's kind of like the culmination of a lot of things within my life. You know what I mean? Like, because obviously I'm not just holding a position, I'm also doing a lot of score work and arrangement. And so it's like, I get to live in the tech space, which has been in my DNA from the time I was literally a kid, making video games from when I was in grammar school, creating music and creating it for ourselves. Like I said, I worked on a lot of game titles, right? But it was always for somebody else, for somebody else's IP, somebody else's property. Yeah, I got paid, but it wasn't mine. You know what I mean? Like, in this case, this is ours. In a lot of ways, and I don't just mean, like, ownership-wise. When things are revealed, it's going to be something that is very much all of ours.
It's kind of crazy. Just Blaze and I have run in concentric music industry circles for the better part of a quarter century at this point. And while we've chatted before, and maybe even shared a meal at some point in the mid-aughts, this was really the first time that we ever sat down to conduct a proper interview. What really struck me was how linearly his success has been born from his twin passions of hip-hop music and computing. And it's fascinating to learn how each has complemented the other and pushed his dreams forward. And how he's found a way to capitalize off both his acuity with computers and his gift for culture creation by working in video games. And with his Brass Lion Entertainment, he's created an opportunity to truly expand the aperture of an entire industry. It's inspiring stuff. Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of the Idea Generation Podcast. I hope it scratched your rap nerd itch and provided you with some inspiration for your journey of creative entrepreneurship. And if you've enjoyed what you heard today, we could really use your help to keep this podcast going strong. The best way to support us is to leave a rating or a review on your favorite podcast platform. It only takes a second, but it can make a world of difference in helping others discover the show. And of course, don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. Thanks again for listening and see you next week. For Idea Generation, I'm Noah Callahan-Bever, and today's episode is brought to you by Tres Generaciones Tequila.